Dear Mata Filipinum, don't cry. Mommy promises you, no one will come and devour you. No greedy whale of a company sharking through political seas. No backwater bullying of businesses with broken morals. No blindfolded bureaucracies gonna push this mother ocean over the edge. No one's drowning, baby. No one's moving. No one's losing their homeland. No one's gonna become a climate change refugee. Or should I say, no one else.
Dear Spoken Words from a Mother to Her Son, a Letter, a Promise by Marshallese poet Kathy Jetmeel Kitchener to her son, Matafele.
And it's a mother's warrior cry that sets the scene for the biggest challenge that we're facing in the Pacific region, climate change.
But more specifically, what does climate action look like in the Pacific? We are talking to leaders who are leading our climate action policy and funding and housing for those who are most vulnerable due to disasters.
Here in Tonga, we're seeing the effects of climate change, with low-lying areas experiencing more high sea levels, cyclones are more frequent and devastating. Join us as we talanoa with people who are working for climate action in the Pacific. I'm Talita.
I'm Trina.
And this is WASA Podcast, supported by the World Bank in the Pacific, but the views and opinions shared here on WASA don't necessarily reflect the views of the World Bank or its member countries. Maloe lele and warm Pacific greetings. In this episode, we're talking about how we, Pacific Islanders, are addressing climate change through climate action.
Our Blue Pacific Highway, our moana, that is a deep part of our culture and everyday life, is the largest and deepest ocean basin on Earth, covering more than 155 million square kilometers and averaging a depth of 4,000 meters, and it's rising because of climate change.
As our polar ice caps melt, water temperatures increase, the ocean expands, and sea levels rise. The changing climate has increased the occurrence of intense and destructive cyclones.
That's right, Mama Talita. Rising sea levels and destructive cyclones have led to displaced people and communities without proper shelter. Habitat for Humanity is one organization responding to that need. Shortly, you'll hear from Dr. Elizabeth Fitton-Higgins, International Programs Director of Habitat for Humanity New Zealand, about how they're responding to the need for more resilient housing.
But first, Mama Trina, do you remember in episode 2, we spoke to Rose Gautoke about the importance of having a seat at the negotiating table for laws and policies that affect our Blue Moana? Those sentiments are echoed by our guest from Fiji, Dr. Sivendra Michael, who is the newly appointed Permanent Secretary for Environment and Climate Change in Fiji. Sivendra told us about his childhood and how he witnessed climate change firsthand without really knowing about the concept until he got to university.
Most of my life I've spent living in a city called Lotoka, and growing up, I think it was so different. My life encompassed going to play outside, you know, you're playing in the mud, going swimming in the river. It was different. Like, I did not know much about, you know, what was climate change. And all of this sort of changed as I grew older and started noting that, you know, the cyclones are coming, people's houses are getting destroyed. Still, the term climate change did not sit with me. I did not know what it was. I did not know its definitional boundaries, because often these are things and terminologies that are like introduced into the curriculum. But growing up, you know, we didn't talk about it so much. It was clearly, I think, my first year of uni when I was attending a kind of student association gathering. There was this professor that was talking about growing impacts of natural hazards, increased frequency of and severity of cyclones in the Pacific. And he's talking about like how people were forced to relocate because the floods were like so often or coming so often.
Mama Talita, Dr. Sivendra speaks truth about growing up in the Pacific. We are living and experiencing subtle shifts and impacts of climate change in our communities. And we were living it two or three generations ago without knowing what the concept was. That's a powerful observation.
It surely is, Mama Trina, and Dr. Elizabeth Fitton Higgins is leading Habitat for Humanity's regional programs in Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, and she talks about how climate change has shifted their response to housing in the Pacific.
The kind of work that we've been doing in communities in Fiji, in Samoa, and in Tonga previously has focused on PASA training, which is participatory shelter awareness training. So that's looking at risk factors in your environment, risk factors in the community, learning about how to strengthen shelter and houses in order to withstand things like cyclones, and work together as a community to then develop projects that address some of the vulnerabilities to shelter within that community. So having that lens was always very much around, well, how does that fit with climate change? But actually, if you break it down, a lot of the vulnerabilities in communities are actually influenced by climate change. And we can see those impacts in communities and hear about them from the communities that we're working with. So, you know, water levels are getting higher. Wash infrastructure isn't up to scratch. The cyclones are getting stronger. That's all climate change. So although we are a shelter organization, actually, what we're realizing is we're a climate change organization. And that's really an area that we're going to be focusing on for the next few years here in the Pacific. And it's a real privilege to be able to do that in partnership with our communities.
The importance of climate-resilient housing is a foundation for being prepared for disasters. So it's important work getting communities ready.
Dr. Sivendra's journey started at the age of 17 at USP, where he eventually became a member of the research team that took him to the village of Vatua in Fiji. And that would be the foundation of his fieldwork perspective, which are the humans at the front line. And it's not just a Pacific problem, it's global.
It was just a matter of, you know, a couple of years where I went into research, started doing a little bit of fieldwork, getting comfortable with the sciences around it, the data around it, and then slowly transitioning into understanding people's perspective. What I did realize over time is that every time I hear a story of a person or some suffering of communities, I always ground myself with the reality that there are communities and individuals out there that are in far worse situation. For example, my brothers and sisters in Kiribati, so my brothers and sisters in Tuvalu, the rate of, you know, changes that they are experiencing in their environment, the atmospheric conditions that cause these hazards to increase in frequency, it's worrying. We tend to read about it and hear stories about it. But when I actually had the opportunity to go and visit these countries, it strikes you really deeply. You're talking about these communities in Bar that is being forced to relocate to a new community amongst the first villages to be relocated. But what about these communities that have been living through king tides? They've been facing being in the front of all these impacts. There are water shortages, there are ocean acidification issues. The coral bleaching is so bad that, you know, the fish, their only source of food from the Moana is no longer there. So it hits you. It hits you so badly that, you know, you're always talking about one region or one particular nation without realizing there are not only those in the Pacific that are in far worse situation. There's countries in the African region, there's countries in the Caribbean region that are experiencing far worse impacts.
Mama Talita, Dr. Sivendra's work has taken him across the globe. And I think it's important to remember that we are all witnesses to climate change, some more than others, but we are bearing witness.
For generations, our ancestors have weathered cyclones and tsunamis, and those lessons have been shared through our indigenous knowledge of foods, the ocean, and right down to architecture. Dr. Higgins speaks about resilience in housing and how supply chains and finding a balance between the modern and indigenous architecture is important for resilience.
So resilience is an interesting piece, isn't it? Because especially in the Pacific, where actually in all three countries, there's a huge reliance on imported materials in order to upgrade or build houses. So that, of course, affects resilience. And we saw that in the aftermath of the volcanic eruption. And you can also see that in the aftermath of tropical cyclones, which are getting stronger due to climate change, that actually supply chains are severely disrupted. And it's very difficult to access decently priced and really good quality building materials. So that impact on resilience is quite significant. And you have this interesting balance where actually there are plenty of natural and local materials that could be used in order to build, but they're not necessarily tested in order to know the strength of different types of wood, for instance. So there is that. We could improve resilience by using local materials, but actually some more research will need to be done in order to do that in a safe way. And similarly, like there's anecdotal evidence that certain building designs, and I'm thinking particularly kind of falaise, so kind of more rounded designs, are much more able to withstand cyclones than the kind of more Western built structures, which are really not, certainly if they're not built properly, really not very resilient to tropical cyclones. But at the same time, there's also certain strengths in the building materials, in the more modern building materials that do make them better shelter and better housing. So we kind of have this tension between indigenous knowledge, indigenous materials, and more Western knowledge and Western materials. But if you go one way too much, then you kind of really impacting the local resilience because you're so dependent on whatever is imported. And if you go the other way too much, then maybe you don't actually have the best quality house available.
What does climate action look like to you?
This is my favorite part of mine, Mama Trina, because then we get to ask this question to our Pacific community. And here's what they think.
Malo te maori mutekataki. I'm Ofeli and I'm from Wallis and Futuna. I think there are different levels of actions, and definitely there is a personal level that is accessible to everyone. It's about having more sustainable attitudes in our everyday lives, picking up our waste when we go to the beach, and trying to sort out our rubbish when it's possible, get into the recycling system as well. Then on a social level, that is in the village, in the tribe, in the kingdom, we can influence each other in the right direction. That means there are local organizations. For example, here in Tonga, we have the No Plastiki campaign. I was very impressed by that. I think there are ways for young people and even adults to get together and take action, because by taking action and doing your part, there will be a rippling effect. And then by creating partnership with the authorities, we can access the third level, that is the institutional one, and try to bring like effective, concrete change into our local societies and national alike.
Hello, Olketa. My name is Jubal Talio and I come from Vanuatu. I'm originally from the village of Pango on the island capital of Port Vila, Rifate. In order for us to combat it or to find a solution towards this common problem, we have to think as a collective. We need to unite. We need to collectively think and think of solutions and put aside our differences once and for all. I believe that conflict is one of the many factors that have been delaying towards implementing a proper combating climate change effectively.
Whakaalofalahi atu, my name is Inangaru Whakaafi and I come from the island of Niue. I also have heritage to the Cook Islands. Our island has embraced a dual strategy of adaptation and mitigation to address, you know, the pressing issues of climate change, and through adaptation measures, things like coastal protection, sustainable land management, and the promotion of resilient infrastructure. Our island aims to safeguard its communities and the ecosystem from the adverse effects of climate change.
The Mama Tees would love to get your thoughts, so be sure to reach out to us via our Vossa social media platforms. Our handle is at Vossa Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and X, formerly Twitter. Dr. Sivendra started out his journey, Mama Talita, in the classrooms of USP, then into fieldwork in Fiji, and eventually landed at the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat as a young researcher.
He was placed in a strategic planning and policy division, talking to different stakeholders on gendered impacts and looking at persons with disabilities and how they are being affected, and he found his calling.
over time, this became life. This was where I was being placed, graduating with an economics degree, coming into a field where I could, you know, utilize my writing skills, my policy development skills into a space where I'm focusing on a development issue, a current development issue. Present day, we are constantly talking about climate change, but there were in the regional organizations, there are whole departments, divisions that are working on different aspects, thematic areas, talking about climate financing. So that was my early days of, you know, being in this space. And to be honest, being alongside different individuals, it also makes you realize that you want to do more for your country, for your region, for your community, for your people that actually have invested so much in helping you get an education. So, you know, you kind of become the vessel of information that tries to share with other people about the communities that are impacted, try to educate others, you know, about, you know, the real-time threats that these communities are facing. And more importantly, I think, is being in conversations and around development practitioners that are continuously shaping policy and laws that try to address these issues.
That's just amazing, Mama Talita. Service to our community that plays a big part in the leadership journeys we've been talking about this season. And Dr. Sivendra is no different. It takes unique individuals to answer that call to service.
It really does. And women play an important role in our homes. We're the nurturers, and sometimes we've also got to step in and be the repairman or plumber. And Habitat for Humanity recognize this, and they are providing training to help upskill women to improve water, sanitation, and hygiene, or WASH, which can prove vital when disasters hit communities.
We all know, actually, women are often the heart of the home. And what we found in our work in Fiji, for instance, is that although traditionally women aren't really encouraged to be part of construction work, it is very much accepted that they are responsible for WASH, because that takes part in the house. So we've had real good success in engaging women in our programming through giving them basic home plumbing training and being able to do like basic maintenance and repairs around the house and improve like the water facilities that they have available to them. So I think that's something that we really want to focus on and get more women involved in that and taking responsibility really within their homes for the quality of the structure and the WASH that they have available.
You know what, Mama Talita? The women are the backbone of the household. And when we upskill them and recognize their importance, it strengthens a community.
I totally agree, Mama Trina. And during our Talanoa with Dr. Sivendra, he talked about finally making it to his first COP meeting, COP21. And he found himself lost amongst the conversations and disheartened in what he was witnessing at the global negotiation tables that would impact Pacific people who are at the front line of climate change.
Found myself lost amongst a wide array of conversations that were happening. So my leaders weeping, crying, you know, demanding and pushing for inclusion of loss and damage. Say, for example, in COP21, which was my first COP, where they were constantly, you know, like lobbying for the inclusion of loss and damage. And, you know, for people like us who actually know what it means to our communities, to have witnessed it back home, to have seen communities relocate and their culture, their sense of identity being affected, it hits you differently. You try to reflect and unpack on everything that you have come through and then be in a room where people are actually pushing back, questioning it, asking why is the text saying this? Can the text include aspects where it is uniformity in the sense that everyone else's voice is there? But at the back of your mind, you are saying, okay, they're talking about all of this, but I know that the people are suffering. Why is there a pushback?
That paints a powerful picture of the negotiating world and what our people are up against. And I can't help but think this played a big role in Dr. Sivendra's journey.
We ask him what he thinks are some of the obstacles for the Pacific to accessing green funds for climate action.
The problem is that the different stakeholders, the different development partners, the different individuals that are coming into this space have very different levels of understanding of how do we contribute to a solution? How can we help address the challenges or mitigate greenhouse emission? How can we help communities adapt? There are various different levels of understanding, which is then compounded by the lack of resources or access to resources. For example, if you look at climate finances that have been coming to the Pacific, particularly from one institute like GCF, you are looking at around 4% of the funding that is coming to the region. That 4% is shared amongst 15 Pacific Island countries that are currently member states of GCF or accredited. There are 15 projects, for example, some regional, some national. Out of 216 projects that have been approved by GCF alone, this is one entity, not Adaptation Fund or others, just the Green Climate Fund alone. From the 216 projects that have been approved for, you know, implementation, only 15 belong to the region. So you can see the level of disparity in which access to climate finance.
Mama Talita, that's a lot to unpack. But Dr. Sivendra points out that the difficulty in accessing climate funds for our region is a big obstacle for our future.
Speaking of future, Mama Trina, we wanted to know what a future climate resilient house looked like and what are some of the important features that make it climate resilient.
So what does a future climate resilient house in the Pacific look like for me? What is the dream? For me, the dream really would be a house that has solid, strong foundations. When we're looking across the Pacific, the research that we've done recently on the housing ecosystem in Samoa and in Tonga and in Fiji, what we really found when we're looking at houses is the quality of houses is generally very low. So, of course, not in every case, but certainly in the more vulnerable communities, there's not necessarily strong foundations, there's not necessarily strapping to make the houses more resilient, the roofs more resilient to things like cyclones. So definitely the foundations and the reinforcement to be more cyclone proof would be a number one priority for me. I'm also interested in things like the use of passive cooling technology, putting on Cooltech roof paint, researching the impact on both indoor temperature but also on physical health outcomes for people living in those houses. So the impact of that Cooltech roofing can actually reduce the indoor temperature by a few degrees, which means that, you know, in the face of increased temperatures across the world, actually that is a relatively simple solution to actually make houses more comfortable for those people living in them. And we want a resilient house to be accessible for all. So the cost, if possible, should be kept as low as possible. And using local resources can be really helpful in reducing that cost, using local trees, using local and traditional building techniques. I'd also advocate for use of water tanks for every house so that there is safe, clean drinking water accessible to the local people and local communities. And I also would say solar and energy efficiency is really important. That would be something for local households. If they could access solar, would reduce their power bills and can also help just maintain that resilience in the face of any hazards that are happening.
I think that's a wish list for climate resilient housing we can aspire to. A good foundation, using local materials, a solid water tank, and solar power. My luxury item, Mama Talita, on that list would be uninterrupted and affordable internet.
And I think you'll find that many of us will agree with you on that. Bureaucracy is the slow death of getting work done, and the paperwork, the rules and regulations, but it's part and parcel of how the climate action funding is being distributed. So Dr. Sivendra speaks about those challenges and how the push for a Pacific Resilience Facility can help access that funding.
So I think, personally, this is my own view, we really need to rethink the role of such institutions in the region. And this is why we are pushing in the Pacific region to have a Pacific Resilience Facility, our PRF, which will be drawing resources and will be more easier to access for Pacific Island countries. And then using that methodology, they can have their own criterion and so forth to then support Pacific Island accredited agencies or however they would like to envision this process. In terms of numbers, people may want to put it in context. So if you are looking at GCF project by geography, currently 14 PICs out of the 54 priority seeds are currently supported through GCF. So like I said, of the 216 something projects, only 20 of them are beneficial to pea seeds, particularly. The approved allocation for pea seeds as of 2000, and the last time I saw this was 2022, is around 521.4 million out of the 12 billion that exists. And in the region as well, there is only two nationally accredited agencies. One is the Fiji Development Bank, the other one is the Cook Islands. The rest of the funding is channeled through ADB, SBC, SPREP, UNDP, World Bank, UNEP, because they have established financial disbursement arrangements. They also have the accountability structures. They also have, you know, the reporting mechanisms in place, which really helps in terms of getting accredited entity. If you put that into context, we are always told that, oh, we lack capacity constraints because there is a lot of administrative capacities that are needed in order to meet these requirements. So personally, I think that this reflects a system that is not prioritizing climate funding by vulnerability for nations like ours. And this needs to go unnoticed by the GCF. Like, they really need to understand the vulnerability of regions and then prioritize allocation accordingly. I mean, that's my one of the biggest challenge. I am talking about access to resources.
The Mama Tees always ask our guests for their gaba bowls or billows of wisdom, and it always hits the mark.
For Dr. Savendra, it's service. This echoes throughout our Talanoa with him. It's service to your community, to your region. So step up. And for Dr. Higgins, it's the big and small things that you can do to influence change.
Even small actions like picking up litter and properly managing household waste can make a massive difference. For instance, flooding impacts communities. If it's clean, then the clear up after the flooding is so much less than if there is a lot of rubbish lying around. So just those tiny actions of just picking up litter and doing community cleanups can really improve things. Small ways, pick up your rubbish. Big ways, talk to those people who have influence. Talk to your local MP, talk to your local town officers, and ask for support for especially those vulnerable communities who are doing it tough in the light of climate change.
When I was growing up, I had very little knowledge. Now that I have the knowledge, it's my job. I make it my job and my responsibility to try and amplify that narrative on what we are doing, what are our issues and so forth. So I encourage everyone to step up, not only for yourself, for your family, for the generations to come, for the communities that have actually invested in you. If you have the education, knowledge, skill sets, step up and contribute. Only together we can address this issue. This is not an issue. Climate change is not an issue that can be solved by one government, by one civil society organization, by one individual, by one person taking a hila and taking the streets. It's not going to stop there. It will take the entire community. We say whole of society. We need to embrace it. Everybody needs to join forces to address it. Of course, there will be climate deniers. There will be people that will be living in denial. Do not make that your problem. You are supposed to be focusing on the solutions. You know very well. Ground yourselves with the reality. Know your why. There is no difficulty or no simpler way to say this.
What a powerhouse we have in Dr. Savendra Michael as an advocate for the Pacific in climate action.
So what's your takeaway from this episode, Mama Trina?
I am always grateful when I hear Pacific Islanders speak passionately about issues that are affecting us. I cannot fathom the complexities and nuances that goes behind navigating the space of policy and climate action funding. So I think we are in good hands if we have people like Dr. Savendra asking the hard questions and being critical, because we need those voices.
I couldn't agree more. For me, though, it's understanding how important a climate resilient house is for the Pacific region. Work still needs to be done in finding the balance between the modern and indigenous knowledge to build a better home. And I think we're on the right path. Till next time, that's it from the Mama Tees.
Ofalahiatu!